From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
There is a point, a certain point, in which you should not go on fighting against censorship. And you should, you are obliged to choose silence. Being silenced, the only way of expressing your dignity, because silence is also language.
Today, a Memorial Day broadcast of a conversation between two giants in literature and politics, Brazilian photojournalist Sebastio Salgado and Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano, in our continued series on art and revolution. Welcome to Democracy Now! And our Memorial Day special. I'm Amy Goodman. As we begin by honoring Bob Dylan and his 60th birthday, playing his song, With God on Our Side, sung by Aaron Neville and the Neville Brothers.
History books tell it, they tell it so well. The cavalry's charge and the Indians fell. The cavalry's charge and the Indians died. Oh, the country was young then, with God on its side. The Spanish American war had its day. And the Civil War to us was soon laid away. And the names of the heroes I was made to memorize, with guns in their hands and God on their side. The First World War, it came and it went. And the reason for fighting, I never did get. But I learned to accept it, accept it with pride. For you don't count the dead when God's on your side. In the 1960s came the Vietnam War. Can someone tell me what we were fighting for? So many young men died, so many mothers cried. Now I ask the question, was God on our side? I learned to hate the Russians all through my whole life. If another war comes, it's them we must fight. And to hate them and fear them, to run and to hide, and accept it, oh bravely, with God on my side. Through many dark hours, I've been thinking about this, that Jesus Christ was betrayed by a kiss. But I can't think for you, you have to decide whether Judas Iscariot had God on his side. As I'm leaving, I'm weary as hell. The confusion I'm feeling, ain't no tongue can tell. The words fill my head and they fall to the floor. That if God's on our side, he'll stop the next war. Jesus loves me, as I know.
Aaron Neville singing With God on Our Side, written by Bob Dylan, on this Memorial Day, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. More than any other living photographer, Sebastiel Salgado's images of the world's poor stand in tribute to the human condition. He defines his work as militant photography. Trained as an economist, the Brazilian photographer Salgado began working as a photojournalist in 1973. Among numerous international awards, he received the W. Eugene Smith Grant in Humanistic Photography and was named Photographer of the Year 2 times by the International Center for Photography. His new book, Migrations, is the product of a many-year trek to more than 35 countries in which he documents the world-altering phenomenon of mass migration. In his 1993 book, Workers and Archaeology of the Industrial Age, Salgado traveled through Europe, India, South America to document the lives of all of us who work for a living, farmers, computer programmers, gold miners. Despite the grim poverty and pain he often captures, Salgado's ultimate message is one of endurance and hope. And then there's Eduardo Galeano, one of Latin America's most distinguished writers, journalists, and historians, author of Memory of Fire, Open Veins of Latin America, and Soccer in Sun and Shadow. He was born in Montevideo, Uruguay. He lived in exile in Argentina and Spain for many years after being imprisoned in Uruguay, and has received last year the first Lannan Prize for Cultural Freedom. Recently, I had the opportunity to go to Santa Fe, where I conducted a public interview with Salgado and Galeano at the College of Santa Fe. The event was sponsored by the Lannan Foundation, and this hour we will spend with Eduardo Galeano and Sebastiel Salgado.
Well, thank you very much for coming out today, though I don't think it took too much to entice you to get a chance to hear these two giants of literature and photography, Eduardo Galeano and Sebastiel Salgado. It is a tremendous privilege for me to be able to engage in a discussion with you. Mainly, I just want to spend a little time encouraging you to speak. The motto of the program we do is really both speaking for yourselves and the exception to the rulers, which I think you both very much are. I've spent the fall immersed in both of your works, watching through your photography, Sebastiel, and through your words, Eduardo, these enduring truths against the lies that we are fed all the time in the United States. In your book, Open Veins of Latin America, you talk about our defeat was always implicit in the victory of others. Our wealth has always generated our poverty by nourishing the prosperity of others. You both are exiles from your own country, and I wanted to start with that idea, how you did begin to create your 4 years difference in age, born in 1940 and born in 1944, from Brazil and from Uruguay. Let's start with Sebastio Salgado. You didn't start off being a photographer.
No, my first experience was as an economist. I work a few years in an international organization as an economist, and the first pictures that I took in my life, I took in Africa, doing a mission joint with the World Bank, and I came to France to do a PhD in economics, and my wife bought a camera to make pictures because she was doing studies of architecture. And I look through his camera, and I really had another vision of the world and another way to communicate with people. And my wife never saw more his camera. And I begin to take photography, and I finish the preparation of my PhD. I get this job to work as economist. And I did my trips to Africa. And when I came back from Africa, same work, very few, because it was necessary work as an economist. And when I came back, my pictures gave 10 times more pleasure than the economic report that was necessary. This moment I take a decision, really to abandon the economy and become a photographer.
Why did you leave Brazil?
Oh, I left Brazil in 1969. It was necessary to leave in that time. The dictatorship was very, very hard in Brazil. And a lot of friends of us were tortured, killed, put in prison. And it was the moment to stay in Brazil and go to the clandestinity or leave Brazil for a while. And we leave Brazil in 69, and we spent 11 years out of Brazil. It was not possible to go back because dictature was too hard. Going back there would be to be to the prison. No?
Eduardo Galeano, you were born in Uruguay in 1940. And you started writing newspaper articles when you were a young teenager. Can you talk about your progression there and why ultimately you ended up being imprisoned in Uruguay?
No, well, I became a writer because I am absolutely unable to do anything else. I mean, I'm completamente inútil. And then I had no choice or I write or I'm almost a motto moron. As a compassionate friend told me. And so I tried some other ways of earning my life or expressing myself, and it was always a disaster. As I was telling today to a journalist, to Michael, a great journalist and friend, and he wanted to know about it, and so I told him that at the beginning, when I was born, my first word, as soon as I appeared between the legs of my mother, I shouted, "Goal!" Which is, goal is the first word of every Uruguayan child. I was not an exception. That's why the maternidades, how is it, the hospital for birth in English, maternidades?
Uh-huh. Maternity word?
Maternities. Are so noisy because all babies are crying, "Goal, goal, goal." So I tried to be a soccer player, and I was great only at nights while I was dreaming, but in the daytime I was a wooden leg disaster. And later I tried to become a saint because I was very Catholic when I was a child. And it was clear since the beginning that my destiny is sing and sing and sing, so it didn't work. And later I tried to be a painter, a designer, And it was always very, very deep, the abyss open between what I wanted to express, what I wanted to say, when I could say. The abyss open between desire and reality. And so I began trying with words. When I was 14 years old, I published my first Maldades. And now I am on the road doing the same things.
So you went from a 14-year-old newspaper reporter to becoming the editor of
several newspapers. Several weeklies and newspapers.
In Montevideo.
Yes, yes. Until the military dictatorship came, like in Sebastian's life, and so I was obliged to leave Uruguay because it was very uncomfortable to be a prisoner, to be in jail. And later I went to Argentina. I was there during almost 4 years. And I was also obliged to go out because it was also very uncomfortable to be dead. I don't like at all to be dead. Death is very boring, and so I had to go to Spain, and I lived there in exile until I could return to my country, and I live there now.
I'm very interested in issues of censorship. What was it like for you, both in Uruguay as you came up against the regime, and then going to Argentina with the crisis, which you wrote for and ran there? How do you express yourself?
Under censorship, it was, I was a director of a magazine, a cultural magazine in Argentina in the first period of exile called Crisis, which was a nice experience in cultural journalism. I'm sure that machines drink at night. So, in the daytime, they have these sort of hangovers and they make all sort of disasters. We made this very interesting experience in cultural journalism in Argentina. Not only me, I mean, we were a team of writers and journalists. Crisis was a very successful magazine, monthly magazine. We sold 35,000 copies per month, which was an incredible figure, an incredible numerito for a cultural magazine. But later, when the military dictatorship came in Argentina, one of the first decrees was about the media, about communications. And it didn't allow any magazine or newspaper to publish non-specialized opinions. It was an incredible decree against the democratic right of expression. And Crisis was a very peculiar magazine because we were writing about reality, but we were all also trying to hear reality's voices. And therefore, almost half of the magazine was occupied not by professional writers, but just by people. People expressing themselves and saying things from, I don't know, their works, their homes, in the streets, the graffitis, all the thousand ways in which people can express the horror and the wonders, the marvels of life. And this was prohibited by the militaries. And so we tried to go on, and it was each day more difficult because some of the members of our team were kidnapped, others were killed, others were imprisoned, others were in exile, and so finally we decided to shut up. Because there is a point, a certain point, in which you should not go on fighting against censorship, and you are obliged to choose silence. Being silenced, the only way of expressing your dignity, because silence is also a language. And we were pushed to this point in which we were obliged to choose between lying, or shut up. And we decided to shut up. And then I went to exile, trying to go on living, to be alive. I enjoy being alive a lot.
Eduardo Galeano, one of the world's most distinguished writers, journalists, and historians. Among his many books, Memory of Fire, the trilogy, Open Veins of Latin America. His latest is Upside Down, a Primer for the Looking Glass World. Also in this conversation at the College of Santa Fe, the great Brazilian photojournalist Sebastião Salgado, as we continue with the conversation after this break here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with our conversation with two giants of literature and photography, Eduardo Galeano, who among his works is Open Veins of Latin America, landmark political and cultural history of Latin America, documenting a pageant of struggle, revolution, and hope, and also Sebastião Salgado, his books, among them Migrations and Workers and Archaeology of the Industrial Age. As we spoke before an audience at the College of Santa Fe, I went back to Eduardo Galeano.
How did you write Open Veins of Latin America?
I read it in 90 nights, during 90 nights, with oceans of coffee. I was in the daytime, I worked. And in the mornings, I was the head of the publishing department of the university. And I earned exactly $120 per month. So it was not enough to feed myself and my family. And so in the afternoons, I was working as an editor in the English sense of the word editor, correcting originals and trying to make readable some impossible books written on the sexual life of bees or something. Impossible. And at night, I was working on Open Veins. So in that period, I didn't sleep during 90 nights. And afterwards, I had an allergia to coffee during a couple of years. But now I'm drinking a lot of coffee, and it's okay.
Sebastião, how did going into exile shape your view of the world and your photography, your art?
It's very difficult to be in exile, because we go to exile, you have the impression that you stay for 6 months, and after that go to 1 year, that go to 2 years, that go to 5 years, and in a moment you have the impression that never more you go back, and the things become to be very, very complicated in your mind. And I remember that when I begin to photograph, I work a lot in Africa. I was work for new agents, work a lot for news. In a moment, it was impossible to me to continue to photograph because my batteries were completely empty of my route. It was necessary in a way to go back. And it was impossible to go back to Brazil because in a moment that the torture and the repression in Brazil was too strong, and I started to travel around Brazil. I came into Paraguay, for example. And from Paraguay, I walked inside Brazil, in the border, in the limit of Brazil, very dangerous, because Paraguay was a country with a big repression also. And I worked a lot in Bolivia, and went back to Europe. And after when the saudade, you know, the need to be, came back to Peru, all this country around the mine. And I met many workers there. And in a moment, I begin to see that I had a body of work, and was a special body of work that was a body of work very, very special because it was to myself, was to be close to the people that looks like the mine people, was the neighbors on the other side, in a way to be close of Brazil. And that was very, very special for me. And until the moment that in 1979, in the end of 79, we had a political amnesty in Brazil. In this moment, it was possible to come to Brazil. And I came back for Brazil. The last day of the year of 79 was possible to come back to Brazil, about 10 years and a half out of the Brazil. And was very special because my wish was to come back to Brazil, to live in Brazil in that time. But I had two children born in France, and one of our children is a Down syndrome child. And in France, the assistance for the Down syndrome was incredible, was really very good. And in reality, I begin to spend a lot of time in Brazil, three months in Brazil, and going, come back. In reality, today the life is about this. We have a house in France, a house in Brazil, and we go and come and want to be between the two, and we stay like this.
Can you talk about the process of doing Terra, your photography
book? The book, Terra. But Terra is a book that I did in 16 years. It was 16 years of shooting. Probably I'm the photographer that most work in the fields in Brazil. It was part of this work that I was shooting around Brazil when it was possible to me to come back in end of 79, 8. I began to travel inside Brazil, travel a lot, to go to places that was necessary to me to go to see again, to turn, to know better Brazil. And I went mostly inside the country. I must tell that I'm born in the fields, I'm born in a farm. I grew in a farm, and when I was 16 years old, that I went to a medium-sized town. And that majority of my pictures I made in the fields. I have very few pictures made in the urban side of the planet. And for me to go to Brazil was to go inside Brazil. And I came many, many different times, many different trips. And 1996, I was photographing the landless movement in Brazil because it was part of my story. This is a story about exodus. And rural exodus is the most important exodus in the planet. We have about 100 million people that live, abandon the fields each year, between 100 million and 110 million people. And in Brazil, my count was, of course, no exception. Brazil, in 35 years, changed from 80% of rural population to close to 80% of urban population today. And it was necessary to me to work with this rural exodus. And I came to work with the landless movement. I worked a lot of them. And in a moment, I saw that I had a body of work that was possible to do a book, to do something. And I discussed with my friends in the landless movement, my publisher in Brazil, and I said, okay, we go to Terra. And but Terra was a book that was necessary to work a little bit different than just photography. And I went to see a friend, Chico Buarque de Holanda, that is a singer, composer in Brazil, and that I respect a lot because he has a body of work in music that is very close of the leftist movement in Brazil, the big fights against the dictatorship. And she accepted to make some music, some composition to put inside of this book, some poetry to put inside the book. And I discussed another friend, a writer, José Saramago, that's a Portuguese writer, Nobel Prize now, and that was very linked to the landless movement, with the leftist movement in Brazil, that accepted to work. And a fourth person, that's my wife, Lélia, that she designed all my books, and we four worked together on this. And she put all the pictures in a sense, and with the music of Chic, with the text of Saramago, and we create a kind of manifest. Terra, for me, was not a book, it was a manifest about the land in Brazil. And we created together with this book one very interesting way to show the pictures. Lélia imagine a show of 50 pictures, having, in reality, was 45 pictures, two posters with the sequencing of these pictures, in order that the person looking at these two posters was possible to build the show. One poster with poetry of Chico Buarque, another with a text of Saramago, and we made 50 posters, we made a kit of posters, and was possible to send this kit for anyone that wished these pictures. And we print 3,500 shows. And I remember when we presented Terra in Brazil, was 17 of April 1997, when we made 1 year of the massacre of Carajás, when they killed 19 peasants there. We had opened just in the town of São Paulo, when we showed the book, we have 36 shows in the São Paulo, in the churches, in the trade unions, in the streets. And these shows went anywhere around the world. We showed the book with the shows happening in the small towns, and we create a movement with these pictures of the Terra. And, but not only in Brazil. The book was published in 8 countries, and we have these shows turn around all countries except the United States. We try to have these pictures, these shows in the United States. Didn't work. We try, we offer the shows. Was not a kind of presentation that works well with the United States. But was a kind of manifest that we present all together.
José Saramago, the beginning of his introduction, his letter, really. He says, "May the idea never enter God's sublime head to journey one day to this land to see for himself whether those people who survive here on the brink between life and death are satisfactorily serving out the punishment that at the beginning of the world he handed out to the father and mother of us all." Why do you think there's such a difference in how this kind of work is received here and in Latin America? And I'd like to ask you both about the Latin American way of seeing.
No, we're facing the same now with the migrations. We show the migrations in Brazil, in São Paulo. We create a full debate around the migration. And the show in São Paulo was for 39 days, came about 238,000 people to see the show. We create an educational program around, and people came, because you are living the problem. You are inside the problem. The debate is the debate of the people that are inside what they are living. Is completely different than to show in a country where the debate is a little bit far away. Where you are speaking about the politics, the base of Republicans and Democrats now for the presidents, you know. It's a different stage. Probably in the States, in the thirds, when you have all the problems of movement of peasants here, and all the fights, probably will be received in another way. Today is a little bit different. Or probably we don't know really how to show the pictures here. And sometimes I'm very upset because people look at my pictures more as an art object. And they are not. They are documents to provoke a discussion, to provoke a debate. And it's not in this side of the fine art that I have interest to show them. And here in the United States, now the documentary photography become a kind of part inside the fine arts that they must be showing a sense in this. And my interest was not this. It is not this. And I believe that is the difference in where the problem, the person are living the problem. They see this as documents to provoke a discussion, to provoke a debate, and I believe that's a little bit different.
Brazilian photojournalist Sebastião Salgado and Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano in an end of the millennium conversation that took place at the College of Santa Fe in New Mexico. And we're going to continue with these two giants of literature and politics after our break. As Sebastião Salgado will tell us, despite his momentous works, Migrations and Workers, photojournalist books of mass movements of people and workers in the industrial age, what he's most known for is his photographs of the time John Hinckley attempted the assassination of Ronald Reagan. And we'll talk to Eduardo Galeano again about more of his work, his latest book, Upside Down, A Primer for the Looking Glass World. If you'd like to order cassette copies of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with this conversation with Eduardo Galeano and Sebastião Salgado, the Brazilian photojournalist whose latest work is Migrations, an epic piece about how the world-altering phenomenon of mass migration has taken place. His images collectively serve as a metaphor for the hundreds of millions of people who, in an elemental struggle for survival, have ruptured their ties with land and tradition in a flight toward other destinies. And Eduardo Galeano, who has written about the human condition, most famous for Open Veins of Latin America, and his other books.
Let me read what Isabel Allende had to say about you and your work and what you do. She was writing an introduction to Open Veins of Latin America, and she said, "He has walked up and down Latin America listening to the voices of the poor and the oppressed, as well as those of the leaders and the intellectuals. He's lived with Indians, peasants, guerrillas, soldiers, artists, and outlaws. He's talked to presidents, tyrants, martyrs, priests, heroes, bandits, desperate mothers, and patient prostitutes. He's been bitten by snakes, suffered tropical fevers, walked in the jungle, and survived a massive heart attack. He's been persecuted by repressive regimes as well as by fanatical terrorists. He's opposed military dictatorships and all forms of brutality and exploitation, taking unthinkable risks in defense of human rights. He has more firsthand knowledge of Latin America than anybody else I can think of, and uses it to tell the world of the dreams and disillusions, the hopes and the failures of its people. He's an adventurer with a talent for writing, a compassionate heart, and a soft sense of humor." And then she quotes you, "We live in a world that treats the dead better than the living. We, the living, are askers of questions and givers of answers, and we have other grave defects unpardonable by a system that believes death, like money, improves people."
Thank you.
wanted to ask you both about this issue of who you choose to present in your work, the voices that you want to be heard. Sebastião, you did unforgettable work in your book, Workers, presenting us, the world, with a view of the Brazilian gold mines. And I was wondering if you can talk about how you discovered these mines, how you got there, what you saw.
I discovered this mine. I photographed this mine in 1986, but my wish was to go to the mine in 1908, when it was my first trip in Brazil, when I was coming back from the exile. And that was impossible, because it was a big gold mine with a huge production, and who was taking care of this gold mine was the federal police in Brazil. That was the police linked with the dictatorship until this moment there. And they never gave me authorization to go there, because it was necessary to them to give the authorization. And I keep trying each year until 1986, when the people that were working in the mine, they create a kind of cooperative, and they become owners of their destiny. In this moment, they gave me authorization to come. And I came, and I spent there about 3-4 weeks with them, and was incredible, this mine. This mine was something so special. I remember when I came the first time in the board of this huge hole, I have all my hair in my that came out in my skin. I saw 50,000 people in a huge space as 2 football stadiums down here. No mechanical instruments, just digging with their hands and speak. Was for me a kind of the noise of the gold inside the spirit of the people. It was something so incredible that I saw. And I spent there this time with them, and I discovered incredible, incredible people there. They become in the end kind of slaves of their wish to become rich. Because each person that was working in a mine, each mine had 2 meters by 3 meters, was about, 3.5 yards, about 4.5 yards. And they were employing about 15, 20 people, each square like this, small. People digging, people transporting. And the day that they get the gold, arriving the gold, each person that was working had the right to receive 1 bag. And until now, they were working just for survival. And in this moment was the chance to have nothing as to have one pound of gold inside, those things like this, because I had a lot of gold. And the people stays, and was forbidden to have women there. They didn't allow the women. And the relations was very, very complicated. In the end, with the so hard work, with big, big violent work, we had a faction that were a faction of the homosexuals. That finally they were working as a valvula discard. Was this the was a security issue for all these people to get not explode? Because in the end, all the social life, the sexual life was being around these works that were homosexual. One incredible thing: I met the leader of the homosexual movement. He was a big fighter against the police, because police was very violent, was a very violent place. He had his bond with holes of bullets, knives that was cut, and he was real love, a leader. And I discussed with him, I said, but what do you want to do the day that we have gold? He said, I want to go to Paris and put a silicone chest as a woman. That was so incredible to see the no, each one has one different mind. He become a slave of a dream in the end, you know. But very few get really gold. You know? But that for me was a very, very, very interesting and dancing experience.
You know? How did you actually photograph this vast mine of 50,000 people?
Well, we had no hotels, no nothing there. It was necessary to live with the miners. And I bring a hammock. And I get a group of people that accept me to live with them. I begin to live with them. And as in photography in these books, I spend a long time in all these pictures. And to do these pictures, it's necessary to live with the people. In the end, it's not really the photographer that made the pictures. It's the relation that photographer built with the people that photographer received the pictures as a gift from the people. In reality, it's this. And I went to work with them 5 in the morning, come back to work with them 6 in the evening, spend full day there inside. In the end, that become your life also. You completely integrate with the process, with the people, and you go in the same places, you work in the same place, you discuss essential things. I believe that the most important thing when you do this kind of photography is to work alone. Because when you are alone, you are a kind of, you have a group that accept you, that assimilate you. If you come with a 2 person, 3 person, you create another group that's very difficult to 2 group, integrate, they touch. Because when you are alone, you have a headache. You said to the person that you have a headache. You are starving, you say that you are starving. You speak about your kids, about your family, and you become part of this community that you began to live. You integrate the community. In this moment, you are part of the community. You receive from the community all kind of things that you have. And that become your way of life.
You talk about militant photography.
No, it is not militant photography. I don't like very much this term. It's a way of life, no? And for me, I did always the same photography. In the end, it's different chapters of my life. This is not a militant, this is a way of life. This is completely different. Of course, that when you go to the places and you meet with people, you receive the pictures, and you must tell what is going on. You have a responsibility to tell the people what is going on. And you must show, you must provoke a debate, you must provoke a discussion, because there is so many injustice. There is so many problems of distribution of health. There is so many problems of security. There is so many injustice around that you must show this. And that become a way of life. It's not, for me, militance is you organize in your head that you do this, you have a mission as a militant. And this is not, this is a way of life, this is your life.
You're the preeminent documentary photographer of our time in the world. You've done Workers, Terra, your latest Migrations. Perhaps, though, how you became most known to people in the United States was the photographer of President Ronald Reagan when John Hinckley attempted to assassinate him. Can you talk about how you ended up being in the United States, in the Oval Office, and at the scene of the crime?
That was very funny, because I didn't supposed to be there. I was in Australia shooting the guys that was hunting the kangaroo. And I was working all evenings, and I became very tired after work to work people that work in opal mines. And I supposed to go back from Australia to France, and I had a friend there that had a ticket that was come from the United States. And this guy was necessary to him to go quick back to London, and we changed tickets. He get my ticket, I get his ticket. And I traveled, I came to San Francisco. He had the ticket, San Francisco, New York, and I came to New York. And arriving in New York, a friend of mine, Fred Richin, that was the editor of photography, the New York Times magazine, said, Sebastian, don't want to go to Washington to do a portrait of President Reagan, because it's a big story for the New York Times magazine about the 100 first days of President Reagan. I said, why not? I go, because it's so important. Man, no, I disagree completely with his point of the view. But it would be interesting to see close, how is this man? And but I had no clothes, because Miss Reagan, she was very strict about how journalists supposed to be dressed around there. And I was working Magnum at that time, at photo agents, and I gone there, and someone borrowed my suit, other borrowed my shirt, and I gone more or less equipped like this. And I met Mr. Reagan one Saturday, and they were very interested, because to have a lot of page cover of New York Times magazine was a point about Ms. Reagan. They accepted very well, and they gave him all the badges to work in the White House. And that was Saturday. Sunday, I met Mr. Reagan. We went to the church and made some pictures, come back, all this. And Monday, he went to do a speech in the Hilton Hotel in Washington. And I tell to the guys, I must go there because I must have many pictures for this article. They said, you don't have accreditation to go to the Hilton Hotel. All accreditation that you have, the badge, is for the White House. I said, but I must go. How can I go? He said, the only way, we cannot put you inside the official cars going, but we put you inside the security car. Like this, they gave him an agent to be guiding me, because I didn't know Washington, the way to come back from there. And they put him inside a truck with at least 15 guys with machine guns, with weapons. And I was sitting there, they are joking with me about my bad English, all these things. And
so you were all prepared to shoot.
And I went, and Mr. Reagan was speaking and inside the Hilton for the people, I believe, that industry of construction in the United States. And I was photographed, and I have a instinct to go out. And I saw two photographers going. I tell to the agent, that was my secure guy from FBI, I said, I must go there. I said, no, they're just the photographers that are in pool. Photographers in pool is two photographers that are assigned where the president goes. The pictures that they do must be distributed for all magazines and agents around the world. He said, just the pool guys that must go. If you want to go, you must turn all the hotel. And I ran to be in the door of the hotel. I remember this guy back to me say, when a president of the United States is around, you cannot run. They can shoot you. He said, but I continued. And he got this FBI thing in the hand and said, FBI, FBI. And I went, and I came in the door of the hotel. Mr. Reagan was come, and I remember I made one picture, one shot, and I hear the tack, 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 the fire, you know. I thought that was fireworks, because in Latin America, when the presidents go out, a lot of fireworks. But immediately, I saw that it was not fireworks, that something was happening. And I was running, I continued. And all these guys that were in security was my guys from the tracks. And they allowed me to come inside, around the car of Mr. Reagan. And I had an incredible series of pictures, because I have Mr. Brad come down with blood come from his head, all this confusion around. In reality, in about 1 minute, 20 seconds, I made 76 pictures. I have three cameras with films, because I was shooting. But the problem that I'm a black and white photographer, in that time I was shooting color. My assignment was color assignment. And I shoot color for many years of my life in black and white, because it was not possible to me to live on for my black and white. And I made a series of pictures, and after this confusion, and people went out, and was there, lost in the middle of Washington, because it was my first trip to Washington. I didn't know how to go back to the White House. And finally, I get a cab, and I went, and I call New York Times, and I tell Fred, Rich, and I say, Fred, they kill our story. Because now they never allowed me to be close to the president, because nobody knew that Mr. Reagan was rich then. And I supposed to fly the next day to Illinois inside the presidential plane to make the pictures. And Fred tell me now, but you made the picture? I said, yes. He said, probably have a big story because the president is rich, he's very sick in a hospital. In this moment, I said, my God, probably my pictures are not good, because I had no time to see the light meters, to see the light was good or not. It was shooting very, very fast. And when it developed, they were okay.
What a story.
That was Sebastião Salgado, the great Brazilian photojournalist, along with Eduardo Galeano, a conversation we had several months ago at the College of Santa Fe in New Mexico. Photojournalist Sebastio Salgado is well known for his work, Workers and Archaeology of the Industrial Age, and his photo journal, Migrations, the product of a 7-year trek to more than 35 countries in which he documented the world-altering phenomenon of mass migration. Eduardo Galeano is well known for his book, Open Veins of Latin America, Memory of Fire, the trilogy, and his most recent book is Upside Down. And as we conclude today's program, the latest news, riot police battled firebomb-hurling youths for the second straight night in a racially tense town in northern England called Oldham. It has been the scene of increasing racial tensions in recent months after a series of rallies staged by members of the National Front, a small but vocal right-wing extremist group that opposes the presence in Britain of Jews, blacks, and other racial and ethnic minorities. The outbreak of violence in Oldham on Saturday night was apparently sparked by an attack by a gang of white youths on a home in a neighborhood whose population largely comes from the Indian subcontinent. At the height of those clashes, which lasted for 7 hours, as many as 500 youths fought pitched battles with police. Tomorrow on Democracy Now, we will replay an interview that former Democracy Now! Producer Maria Carriadon did with Korda, the great Cuban photographer. He died on Friday in France during one of the exhibitions of his photography. We end today's program with Bob Dylan singing his own song, With God on Our Side.
First World War, boys, it came and it went. The reason for fighting, I never did yet. But I learned to accept it, accept it with pride. I get down, count the days. Shot the worldwide, and you never ask questions when God's on your side.
And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony 1857 Sloan is our engineer, Errol Maitland our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now! And have a reflective Memorial Day as we go out with Bob Dylan, who turned 60 last week.
Jesus Christ was betrayed my King, but I can't think for you. You have to decide whether to lose the Iscariot high.